From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
You're familiar with the word mafia?
Yes, Mr. Watson.
This week, News International executive James Murdoch was roughed up by British MP Tom Watson and the parliamentary committee investigating his company's phone hacking scandal. For those who watched the previous round of hearings, Murdoch's performance was familiar. He continued to claim to have been in the dark about the pervasive culture of skullduggery at News Corp, the company he runs, which led Watson to compare him to a clueless capo.
Mr. Murdoch, you must be the first mafia boss in history who didn't know he was running a criminal enterprise.
So how did a global media magnate's son come to be slammed as an Aussie Don Corleone? Or maybe Fredo. It started last July when the Murdoch-owned British tabloid News of the World was shuttered after the paper was found to have routinely hacked into voicemails to get scoops. Since then, a broader picture of misconduct has emerged. It seems that many more people were eavesdropped on than anyone knew. The estimate is now around 5,000. And not just public figures, but ordinary Britons, too. The resulting outrage has put the entire British media on trial, and a panel has been appointed to look into stricter regulations for the newspaper industry. Alan Rusbridger is editor of The Guardian, the paper that broke the phone hacking story. He says that when the ugly truth first surfaced, the Murdoch family tried to scare off lawmakers who sought to punish News International.
A lot of the MPs who were most vociferous in pressing this case have now come out and said that at various points they've been threatened.
It was often said that Murdoch papers could make or break a campaign.
That's why Tony Blair, when he became Prime Minister, travelled all the way to Australia to address a Murdoch conference. People believe that you couldn't get elected without Murdoch. You had papers that set the tone of the debate, and if they didn't like you, they could make life very uncomfortable for you, including, as we now know, this sort of criminal underworld who would dig into the private life of people in your party or whatever. So these were bad people to make an enemy of.
So lay out the parameters of the trial of the British media.
There's this very big inquiry headed by a judge, the Leveson Inquiry, which is looking at standards and ethics across the British press. And what we've seen so far is some very barnstorming speeches from tabloid editors who are standing up and saying, this is an out-of-touch judge with out-of-touch retired posh press advisors who don't understand the tabloids, and we have to stand defiantly in front of these judges to stand up for press freedom and fight off any greater regulation.
Well, the self-regulating British press is overseen by a board of press people. The chairman of the Codes Committee is the editor of the Daily Mail, not exactly a paragon of journalism either.
That's what this committee is going to look at. The question is, if you're going to have regulation, then it has to mean something. The judge will be looking at not state licensing of newspapers, but how you make sure that everybody will be compelled to give the evidence that the regulator needs and whether the regulator can impose sanctions. Now, I'm sure to American ears this sounds extraordinary. I've never yet met an American journalist who can understand why the British press puts up with any kind of regulation.
I have to say that I am in this camp. It seems the best that I think we can hope for is to suck it up when an unbounded press oversteps its bounds so that it can do its job when it's functioning the way it ought to function.
I think the difference between the British and other markets, so we had a debate recently where we had Carl Bernstein, who was essentially making the First Amendment, the press needs to be completely free. And we had a French journalist who said, well, in France, essentially, we don't have a tabloid press, so we don't have the problem.
Well, la-di-da.
In America, you have a tabloid press, but it tends to be a weekly kind of a supermarket press. You don't have...
Well, we have the New York Post, a Murdoch property.
The New York Post is much more, in British context, a mid-market tabloid.
So not a scandal sheet.
It's not a scandal. So you've got something which mixes entertainment and news. And what you saw in the phone hacking saga was two things. One, you saw the techniques leaping the firewall from celebrity reporting to political reporting to reporting on anybody. And you also saw this situation where the police themselves felt intimidated. So there's one argument that just says leave the police to regulate. There is a law against this stuff, so you don't need a regulator. But the police themselves were frightened of the papers. I mean, that's the strong suspicion. I think realistically, after the kind of scandal that's been revealed, we're going to have a tightening of regulation. It's the press's job to make sure that the judge understands that whatever he comes up with is not going to inhibit serious investigative journalism of the sort that we all know when we see it.
Do you think that the ones that have been considered so far would threaten the way The Guardian does business?
I haven't seen anything so far that would threaten what we do. In the end, it comes down to this very slippery notion of what the public interest is. And I think if you can go before a judge or a regulator and say, look, this is why this story was in the public interest, you should be okay.
So we can't trust the police, but we can trust the judges.
Well, I don't trust anybody, no. And the judges are as fallible as anybody else. But on the other hand, we've got into a very bad situation where one or two newspapers have done such unpleasant things that they've saddled the rest of us with the consequences.
Alan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Alan Rusbridger is the editor of The Guardian newspaper.
Nobody, at least nobody who ever read a sports page, ever believed the following sentence would be uttered. This week, Joe Paterno was fired. Why? Because of what the venerated 84-year-old Nittany Lions coach didn't do in connection with the child sex abuse case against his former assistant coach, Jerry Sandusky, a case that has rocked the Penn State campus and the world of college football.
Penn State is cleaning house. Legendary football coach Joe Paterno and the college president.
Downtown State College to protest Paterno's ouster. Officers in riot gear used pepper spray to control the crowd.
In a statement, Paterno himself admitted his actions did fall short, and he wrote, "This is a tragedy. It's one of the great sorrows of my life."
The arrests of athletic director Tim Curley and Gary Schultz, the university's senior vice president for finance and business, for allegedly covering up the scandal, were reminiscent of the Catholic Church's complicity in protecting pedophile priests. But Joe Paterno, who was fired for failing to diligently pursue allegations against Sandusky, is no anonymous administrator. He is a legend, the winningest coach in the history of big-time college football, and a man who long ago was beatified on the way to being deified by the sporting media. One of thousands of journalists who contributed to the Paterno legend is Frank Fitzpatrick, columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of two books about Paterno and Penn State football. Fitzpatrick says the church analogy is particularly apt.
You know, no one will ever look at the Pope or the Catholic hierarchy in the same way again, and you know, in a like manner. No one's ever going to view Joe Paterno in the same way ever again. So I want to make clear that Joe hasn't had that chance to give his side of the story yet, but if these allegations are true, it turns the whole Joe Paterno story on its head.
Print reporters, columnists, most especially, it seems to me, TV producers and game announcers over the years have been just extraordinarily fulsome about the man. At certain points, it veered on the comical in covering Paterno and in writing your books. Did you personally react to the degree of the rapturousness of the prose?
I always tried to point out that as adored as Joe Paterno was in college football, there was a certain segment of the population, particularly among coaches, who seemed to be the focus of his criticism over the years, people that did things ways Joe wouldn't do it, who saying that Joe was sanctimonious, was holier than thou, was, when in fact, you know, he was just like anybody else. If he didn't have these people idealizing him in such a way, you know, maybe we'd all have a different view of St. Joe.
His athletes have had a higher graduation rate than athletes at other major football schools. His players have had a lower incidence of felony arrests, it seems to me. There's been no evidence that he hasn't lived up to the image of the man beyond reproach.
No, that's true. Like any mythology, there's truth at its core, and certainly this cast his entire career in a different light, but it would be a shame if this indiscretion, as large and heinous as it might be, were to overshadow 60 years of an admirable record.
You know, I believe that if the allegations are true, what Curley and Schultz did is worse than child abuse, and I say that for the following reason. Pedophiles are born with these impulses that it's their job to fight, when they're weak and when they fail and when they commit crimes, it's horrible, but they're afflicted. People who enable them, whether it's the Vatican or allegedly the athletic director of the Penn State Nittany Lions, they are not afflicted. They're simply making the most expedient choice, the most cynical possible choice that results in more children being harmed.
No, you're right. I mean, you can make that argument that what drove Sandusky is a sickness, but you know what these other people did is purely cold and calculating, and I just can't fathom it. I mean, it's sickening.
You are a Joe Paterno biographer. Let's just say you were starting that project today. Where do you begin?
I understand Paterno addressed his team. He broke down in tears. To me, that would be the opening scene. I mean, I would wonder, what's behind these tears? Is it a guy that realizes he's nuked his reputation and his legacy? Is it someone that's finally recognized the evil that's at the heart of this whole matter? Or somebody who's disappointed in himself and feels bad for his players who had nothing to do with this and now have to kind of suffer the consequences?
Is there anything you've written about Paterno, either in your books or in columns over the years, that just you wish you could have back?
Well, just about everything now, Bob. We are all going to view Joe Paterno for as long as he's on this earth and beyond through the prism of this scandal. To think of it in terms of Joe's legacy, think of the obituary that will be written when he's died. This is going to be in the lead. I mean, there may be other elements to that first paragraph of that obituary. It may say he was a great coach who won 2 national championships and tried to do things the right way. But believe me, there's going to be a mention of the scandal in there and his great failing. It's as if Abraham Lincoln had slaves or something. I mean, there's this moral compromise that you never thought possible.
Fitz, thank you very much.
All right, Bob. Take care.
Frank Fitzpatrick is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of The Lion in Autumn.
Coming up, the world's biggest focus group. Really, really big.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Somewhere in Virginia, in an undisclosed location, a group of CIA analysts spend their days combing through the world's tweets, blogs, and Facebook pages in an attempt to determine the mood of people around the globe. Doing this type of sentiment analysis allows the people at the CIA's Open Source Center to predict such events as the Egyptian Revolution. Kimberly Dozier covers intelligence and counterterrorism for the Associated Press. She was given exclusive access to the CIA's Open Source Center. Kimberly, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here.
So did they blindfold you and drive you to the secret headquarters?
No, they gave me the address, and I drove through the front gate.
So the analysts at the Open Source Center wade through tweets, blog posts, Facebook updates.
This is the successor to the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, something that existed at the CIA before 9/11 that looked at the traditional stuff like newspapers and radio channels, broadcasts overseas. And then after 9/11, the 9/11 Commission asked that an open source center be set up. Now, looking at social media, that's something that was driven by events. They said in 2009, their analysts were watching what was happening with the Iranian Revolution when people took to the internet and said, we don't like this election. And that's when they started hiring people and also just retasking some of their analysts to start tracking this stuff. I got to say, because they kept stressing it to me, we're not watching Americans. That's not our remit.
Even though they are not actively watching Americans, they're bound to bump into them as they go through Facebook and Twitter. I assume once you're on the radar, you stay there.
When they come across Americans' broadcasts or messages overseas, they have to ignore them. If they can identify them as being from a U.S. citizen who is not engaged in some sort of espionage or terrorism or something that they're supposed to be watching for. However, okay, if you are mining 5 million tweets a day, I don't know if you're looking at that much information that there's any possible way to exit out. But the comeback that they gave me was also, look, this is not something covert. We're just watching what people think and right. reporting back so the policymakers can make smart decisions.
The director of the Open Source Center said that these analysts are called ninja librarians.
What makes a ninja librarian, the director said, is someone with a master's in library science.
A very scary field.
I have received emails from librarians across the country who say, finally, someone understands what we can do. Who knew it was going to be the CIA?
Also, it helps to have multiple languages.
Especially if you grew up speaking one of them at home, Arabic, Russian, one of those really hard languages to understand the idioms and the jargon in. That helps the analysts communicate, all right, what are the other layers of meaning here? They have really had a push over the past few years to push these analysts out to the field, let them spend a year or two in a region that they've spent their whole lives studying so that they know the feel of the place.
What are the limitations of this type of sentiment tracking? I know they look at television, which most people can see, but it focuses on the internet, and that limits the sample, right? Especially overseas.
And they're very upfront about that. They say that tracking stuff on the internet means we're probably getting the top slice of the socioeconomic part of any country, the people who can afford to have a computer in their homes or can afford to go to an internet cafe. But he said you'd be surprised at the number of people who are accessing the internet through SMS text messages. He said that's really increasing their ability to monitor the mood, for instance, across Africa, because almost everybody has a cell phone. One of the problems that the Open Source Center foresees is that increasingly people are relying on closed SMS networks. The Taliban, for instance, uses a closed subscriber network in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. So you're going to have the NSA penetrate that and then get it back to the analysts at the agency, probably not the ones at the Open Source Center.
What we're talking about here is basically a way to track the chatter in the cyber world. And, you know, this is something we've all been hearing about chatter for a long time, chatter about a possible terrorist attack. Is this where it's been coming from all this time?
They have been doing this for a long time. And a lot of folks, even on Capitol Hill, who are supposed to know about this stuff, didn't realize that this was going on to this extent. After the Arab Spring, the intelligence community took a hit for allegedly not having been watching this at all. And the fact of the matter is, they were. They say, we can tell you the mood on the street, but we can't predict the moment that a street seller would set himself on fire in Tunisia, setting off a revolution across the Middle East. But they'll also tell you that they have been asking themselves, are we too focused on terrorism? Did we not look at strategic intelligence, what way a country is going to go? And then when Director David Petraeus took over at the CIA, he thought that something like the Open Source Center was something he'd have to fix. He was relieved to find they were already doing it. The fact that he's opened its doors kind of shows you he's all for raising their profile.
Right. General, now CIA director, David Petraeus, is an extremely media-savvy guy.
One of the things Petraeus wants to do is tell more of the agency's story, especially with budget cuts coming. Last time there were major budget cuts in intelligence in the 1990s, the Open Source Center lost hundreds of people. And, you know, General Director Petraeus knows the value of a good story on Capitol Hill when people have the budget scythe in their hands.
Kimberly, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Kimberly Dozier covers intelligence and counterterrorism for the Associated Press. Her book, Breathing the Fire, Fighting to Survive and Get Back to the Fight, is now out in paperback. Profits from the book go to Wounded Warrior Charities.
The CIA didn't invent the use of sentiment analysis. Researchers have been exploring this area for some time and applying mood tracking in all sorts of ways. Johann Bolin is a professor at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing. He says that with all the words and observations and opinions now available on the web, we really can nail the zeitgeist.
For quite a while, people have been devising computer algorithms to extract information from what they call natural language, to have computers detect a particular sentiment or mood in general And these developments really have come to a head in the past 5 or 6 years with the availability of very large-scale online text databases.
Who else is using this technology to plumb the zeitgeist?
Recently, I've seen quite a few publications on analyzing Twitter chatter about symptoms. You can actually extract information from those texts to determine whether that person is infected with a particular viral disease like H1N1 or influenza. Anything involved with public health, public policy, and sort of socioeconomic phenomena, including the financial markets, is looking at this type of chatter.
Wall Street's your particular expertise. You did a research study showing that you could predict movements in the market 3 or 4 days in advance based on the public mood beforehand. And you're not just looking for gonna buy, gonna sell. There's other kinds of language that your crawler is looking for. What are the keywords?
Well, it's not just a limited set of keywords. What the algorithm does is that it looks at the particular phrasing, the grammatical structure of tweets. Our sentiment analysis is not limited to just determining positive versus negative mood states. It actually looks at a range of different dimensions, including calm versus anxious, happy versus sad. And from that emerges a pretty sophisticated picture of the general public's mood state at a particular point in time.
One of the problems with this kind of algorithm is the language itself. Sometimes language, and especially idiom, can be kind of misleading. For example, words like kill, stupid, filthy, even retarded can mean the opposite of what they appear to mean. They're actually superlatives in common parlance. How does the algorithm deal with linguistic misdirection?
It's really difficult to detect sarcasm and irony, and I would actually argue that's equally true for people. You know, when you send an email, you have to be very careful that your particular emotional state isn't misinterpreted by the person who receives that email. And so the same applies to our algorithms. They're not fail-proof, but when you apply them over tens of millions of tweets on a daily basis, then what you're detecting is some kind of a general notion of the public's mood state.
I've been arguing for years that qualitative research, focus groups and the like, are not research at all. They don't generate data. It's statistically insignificant, easily manipulated, and from my perspective, just as likely to be exactly wrong as exactly right. But it seems to me that what you're dealing with is something that deals with all of my objections, because you've got the world's largest focus group.
You've got about 750 million people on Facebook and a couple of hundred million people on Twitter, and those are such large chunks of the world's population all in all that you may not have a representative sample, but definitely a sample that meets the requirements in terms of significance. The most important thing here is that when you explicitly ask people about their opinion on a particular topic, very often people say one thing, but that's not really what they believe, but that's what they believe the interviewer or the person asking the question would like to hear, that which is socially acceptable. But online, very often it's anonymous. They disclose a lot about themselves, a lot about their opinions, and sometimes involuntarily.
Disinhibited in a good way.
Well, it's not always clear whether it's in a good or a bad way, but at least it's honest.
Johan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Johan Bolin is a professor at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing.
In 2002, artist and professor Hassan Alahi was detained at Detroit Metro Airport by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Somehow, his passport had triggered some kind of terrorism alert, and he spent the next 6 months in and out of interrogation rooms sharing every detail of his habits and movements, which, as a compulsive record keeper, he had. Thanks to that wealth of personal information at his fingertips, he was cleared. Whereupon, Elahi began trackingtransience.net. He calls it an experiment in self-surveillance. Essentially, he inundates the FBI and the rest of the world with personal data. It's the ultimate in TMI. Hassan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me here.
So, tell me about your initial encounter with the INS.
It was absolutely something out of a movie. You know, I come out of the airport, I hand my passport over to this guy, and he blanks and then takes me through this rat maze at the Detroit airport. And I'm in an INS detention facility. And it was there I was met by an FBI agent. And the FBI agent asked me all sorts of details about who I was with, why I was there, who pays for my trips, every little detail. Then he asks me out of nowhere, where were you September 12th?
2001?
Exactly, yeah. This was in June of 2002, so it was shortly after. They had received an erroneous report that an Arab man had fled on September 12th who was hoarding explosives. Now, never mind I'm not Arab, never mind it wasn't the 12th, never mind there were no explosives there. But, you know, we're going under this approach that, well, if you have a Muslim name, then you must be Arab, and if you're Arab, then you must have explosives. I think he realized that I was no threat, and he let me go. He said, well, I'm going to pass this on to the Tampa office. They're the ones that initiated this. They'll follow up with you, and we'll get this cleared up.
And you asked him for a letter stating that you weren't guilty of any crimes, but the FBI wouldn't give it to you.
I travel a lot, and as an artist, you know, you go wherever there's work. So I said to him, guys, all we need is the last guy at the last airport not to get the last memo, and here we go all over again.
Why wouldn't he give it to you?
Well, the problem is, in order to be formally cleared, you have to be formally charged. As Americans, we tend to think that, you know, we have these rights and these proper legal procedures. But when it comes to terrorism and national security, frankly, all that goes out the window. And in this case, there was no law. So at that time, they couldn't really issue a statement of any kind. So they said, well, you know what? If you get into trouble, here's some phone numbers. Give us a call. We'll take care of it. I would call the FBI and I would tell them, hey, this is where I'm going. Not because I had to, but I chose to, just to make sure that everything was okay and everyone knew what I was doing.
And so you started with emailing the FBI, and then there were longer emails, and then you added pictures, and then you added links to websites you'd made.
So I started creating this little device that would share everything about me, every little detail. And then I basically turned my phone into a tracking device, into something similar to an ankle bracelet. So everyone, well, including the FBI, would know where I was at any given moment.
And let's talk about the sort of stuff you sent. The airports you'd slept in, the food you'd eaten at home, the food you'd eaten on the road, random hotel beds you'd slept in, parking lots you'd parked in, photos of tacos you ate in Mexico City between July 5th and July 7th, pictures of the toilets you used. I mean, this had moved from ad infinitum to something approaching ad nauseum.
I've come to the realization, guys, you want to watch me? That's fine. I'm okay with that. But you know what? I can watch myself better than you guys ever could. And that's what was really exciting about this project, is that it really turns this surveillance upside down on its head. Intelligence agencies, and it doesn't matter who they are, all operate in an industry where their currency is information, and it's the restricted access to the information that makes that information valuable. By me borrowing the simplest of all economics principles and flooding the market, the information that the FBI has about me has no value whatsoever.
Is it because by offering so much, they can't use it? Or the scarcity issue, you know, diamonds are valuable because there aren't that many of them?
It's actually a little bit of both. I live an incredibly private and anonymous life because there is so much noise out there. So I've actually created this data camouflage on one side. On the other side, yes, because there's so much there. Again, it has no value. Let's take a very pragmatic example. So, on Facebook, when you have that one friend that only has four pictures of them, you go and look through all four of those pictures. But when they have 500, you don't bother looking at all 500. And the thing is, we're already doing this. When I first started this project, people thought I was crazy. But yet, now that you look at it, just Facebook alone has 800 million users. If that was a country, that would be the third largest country in the world, after China and India.
How do you control the information? You don't edit it, it seems.
It's a very user-unfriendly interface, and it's intentionally user-unfriendly. And one of the reasons being is that I'm hoping that the viewer has to go through the role of playing the FBI agent and cross-referencing this database with that database, and in that detective work, coming to the realization, wait a minute, this could be me. We're in such an absurd age, the way we think of government surveillance, the way we think of wiretaps. And the only way you can really counter such an absurd system is by going even further absurd with this. I mean, when you're looking at my photos and you're seeing all the toilets and all the food and all the beds, there is a sense of sarcastic, comedic side to it. But at the same time, I'm talking something incredibly serious. And I think artists have a different level of agency where we're able to react to situations differently. instead of actually fighting this, I can comply, and maybe even to the point of aggressive compliance. And by doing that, it actually neutralizes this whole situation.
And yet, you've written that your server logs indicate repeated visits from the Department of Homeland Security, the CIA, the National Reconnaissance Office, and the Executive Office of the President. You have everything out there. So what are they looking for?
You know, this baffles me. And it's not just those. I mean, if it's a three-letter agency of some sort, they've shown up. Maybe it's just someone being curious. Maybe it's just, hey, check out this guy that's doing this wacky project. But on the other hand, what if it's not? The hits are frequent enough to make me concerned. It's hard to say you're paranoid when you actually have proof that they indeed are watching.
Hassan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Hassan Elahi is an associate professor and interdisciplinary artist at the University of Maryland.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, supporting Small Business Saturday, and committed to supporting small businesses every day. ConstantContact.com/Saturday. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A few years back, someone at the struggling Washington Post had a fantastic idea. Why not include links in the book reviews published online, allowing readers to easily click through to Amazon.com in search of the title being reviewed? Not only would they save a step, the Post would earn an affiliate marketing fee for each transaction. A win-win was the thought. At least, that was the first thought. There were second thoughts as well.
I think the fear or the concern was that this was going to convey to our readers that we were in some way in business with Amazon.
Washington Post media reporter Paul Fahrey.
And that not only were we in business, that it would in some way infect our editorial independence, that this was an unholy alliance and that the reader would be in some way hoodwinked, shortchanged, or in some way the editorial process would be compromised by this relationship.
Maybe it's a stretch to imagine Post editors favoring positive reviews and mass market books in order to pump up affiliate revenue, but the deal would have created a financial incentive to do so. Therefore, lest the conflict undercut editorial credibility, the plan was shelved. After all, for an industry that has historically maintained a firewall between advertising and editorial, there is plenty of reason, even in financial extremis, to avoid the slippery slope. Because the slope is indeed slippery. Slimy, even. Consider the recent experience of Gawker blogger Hamilton Nolan. He received an email from a New York marketing agency called 43A, offering him a cash payment for including in his blog posts hyperlinks to the agency's clients.
His essential pitch was, look, you know, you, the writer, insert these links for our clients and make them seem very natural. And, you know, if your editor or anybody says anything, just take it out and say it's not a big deal. And if nobody says anything and you can slip it in, then we'll pay you X amount of dollars per link.
We contacted 43A, but they never got back to us. Nolan also stopped getting replies when he started asking damning questions, but not, he says, before the X amount was fixed at $170 per clandestine ad.
Somebody contacting a writer directly and saying, I'd like to put some money in your pocket to stick ads in your posts is pretty clearly to me just a bribe.
Now, you work at Gawker.
Yes.
As I understand it, your compensation is somewhat dependent on page views for your pieces, which gives you an incentive not to report on soil erosion policy unless it's being articulated by a major Kardashian, okay? Is there any difference ultimately between that sort of financial incentive and straight up blogola?
Yeah, there's a lot of difference. At this point, we get paid based on the performance of our site as a whole. So in other words, if Gawker itself gets over a certain number of page views per month, we might get a bonus. That's not a bribe. That's a performance incentive for doing your job well. They're not really related at all in my mind. And by the same token, you know, any journalist today, if you work for the New York Times, if the New York Times doesn't perform well, people are going to get laid off. You know, so in that sense, every journalist everywhere has an incentive for their news outlet to do well.
Yeah, yeah. The "you only want to sell newspapers" argument. One we usually hear from scoundrels who don't like their news coverage. But reporters have always had a ready retort. "Sir, I do not work on commission." The utter indirectness of financial incentive for journalists was the mortar in the firewall. But in the online world, where profitability is elusive and page views are the coin of the realm, the divider between advertising and editorial is less firewall than shower curtain. When advertising is tied directly to content, the incentive for editorial corruption increases exponentially.
So you're right. It is a slippery slope, but it also does create more journalism out there.
That's Richard So, CEO of the Seattle marketing and PR agency Pseudosound Consulting.
It may not have the same standards as the traditional forms of journalism that have existed in the past. And that's an interesting thing. From a marketing perspective, there is a delicate balance. And I think the PR professionals out there kind of bear the brunt of wanting to keep journalists happy and maintain that quality of reporting while also inserting marketing messages if possible.
Consider Infolinks, a company that strikes deals with content providers to embed hyperlinks. It uses double underlines to alert readers to the fact that it's an ad triggered by keywords within the text. If you choose to ignore the double underlined term, you can. If you choose to hover over it with your mouse, the ad pops up. Tomer Travis is the chief marketing officer at Infolinks.
For the advertiser, this is a golden opportunity of a reader that have given permission to be exposed to the ad. And from the publisher point of view, 90% of the readers are not even interrupted. So this is a very good user experience. And yet the publisher is being compensated for the free content that they give online.
Super. But what happens if the publisher decides to skew the editorial content to attract more ads? For instance, the gossip site TMZ is one of Infolinks' content partners. What if TMZ recognized that, say, life insurance was a keyword and suddenly ignored celebrity trash talk and took an editorial interest in financial planning? Travis says no publisher wants to push away its audience and that, anyway, Infolinks' own future hinges on readers having a satisfactory experience, which is why, he says, his ad placement algorithm is constructed to sniff out such shenanigans.
It will always be a race between people who try to exploit it and the technology and the companies that are getting better and better at it. But having some risks doesn't mean that we have to close it entirely, because we still need a business model to allow these websites to keep on providing good content.
At the moment, the only actual traditional newspaper to sign on is the Jerusalem Post. That site is riddled with infolinks, some of which yield mystifying connections. The word Thursday gets you a PC file backup service, negotiating gets freedictionary.com, and the House of Representatives gets you an in-home assisted living ad. I'm happy to report that thus far there does not seem to be an unusual concentration of elder care stories in the Jerusalem Post. But back at the Washington Post, things have changed a bit. The Amazon link in book reviews idea was eventually taken off the shelf and instituted as originally conceived. So far, says Paul Fahey, who more than once has covered his own newspaper's failures on editorial sanctity issues, there has been no sketchy behavior that he can detect.
We've been doing it now for quite a while. There have been zero complaints, as far as I can tell, and zero controversies. This is done so routinely that it's just kind of like putting a headline on the story. The process is almost mechanical.
It's also free money when it is needed most.
And as you may have noticed, newspapers are in some trouble these days, the Washington Post being one of those newspapers that isn't exactly growing. So if you discover this new source of revenue and you can preserve your editorial independence, those two statements are linked, why not?
Fari knows why not. Theoretical conflicts have a way of mutating into actual conflicts. Not all links are hinky, but that slope is mighty treacherous.
The media are drawn to characters with multiple personalities. It's not hard to see why. The afflicted, though often in pain, are able to live out a fantasy that many healthy people have, to be someone else for a while, to live another life. Dissociative identity disorder, as it's now known, is very rare in real life, but it's left an indelible mark on pop culture, from the classic film Three Faces of Eve to Showtime's recent United States of Tara, the story of a mom with multiple, often flamboyant, personalities.
I will be in control. Me, Tara.
This is all your fault, with the drugs and the black
music. Me, Stepford. Buck had the big night out. I wasn't even...
Hey, I was doing important stuff. Just happened to be at a casino.
I, for one, think it's about time you asserted yourself.
Our fascination with split personalities goes way back. Think Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But in modern times, it's been supercharged by Sybil, a 1973 bestseller about the treatment of Sybil Dorset, a pseudonym for Shirley Mason, by her psychoanalyst Cornelia B. Wilbur. The book was made into a miniseries of the same name in 1976 and again as a TV movie in 2007. The book and the movies met every expectation we'd come to have about those afflicted with the disorder. Sybil was young and fragile, fraught with warring personalities, saved by the ministrations of a kind and brilliant doctor. But as journalist Debbie Nathan found, not only is Sybil's story not what it seems, it gave rise to a kind of epidemic.
There had been a few dozen cases over decades and decades and decades, almost 200 years. And then by the early 90s, there were 40,000 that had been diagnosed, and there were countless other people who were just self-diagnosing. In the 80s, every investigative news show would have therapists on with their patients. And it would become like a dog and pony show. The therapist would say, "Can I talk to Amy?" The woman's eyes would flicker, and all of a sudden there'd be, "Hi, you know, it was the child." Then there'd be an old man, and then there'd be an evil, devilish type person, and they'd do a whole show.
So when did the press become fascinated with this whole syndrome?
The press has been fascinated with the syndrome for over 100 years. In the late 19th century, for example, there was a woman down in Brooklyn. She was called the Brooklyn Enigma. She lay in bed and supposedly had a dual personality. She could go for months and years without eating a smidgen of food. There was another case in 1905. That case was made into a play called The Case of Becky. That was made into one of the first silent movies. Every single case after that, where there was a woman who was sort of an attractive, interesting woman, like the Three Faces of Eve, turns into a movie. Sybil, 40 million people saw it, one-fifth of the population. There's a core in our culture that's fascinated with the idea of the opposition between good and evil. The older multiple personality cases were almost always about a split between two, the good and the bad girl. It's only recently that the personalities have proliferated. 16, 100, 4,000. But
somebody has actually 4,000?
4,500, I've heard of. So you have experts wanting to find it. You have the media becoming obsessed. I think there was something about the idea of splitting that was really compelling for young women during that time, the early 70s. All these new roles were opening up for us, all these new jobs, all these new, even sexual roles. I found so many letters in the archive that I used to do this book from young women during that time writing about those conflicts, writing to the author of Sybil. I think that's really what it was about.
Can you give a summary of how the Sybil story came to be in the form it's come down to us?
Sybil's real name was Shirley Mason. She was born in the early 20s in rural Minnesota. And she was a very imaginative child, very fantasy prone. And she was a very conscientiously religious girl and felt a lot of guilt about these artistic impulses she had. She met her psychiatrist in 1945, and the psychiatrist became very smitten with her and started actually giving her literature to read about multiple personality disorder. Sybil was a very emotionally needy young woman, really wanted attention from the therapist, and walked in, knocked on the door one day of the office, and said, "Hi, I'm Peggy."
"My name's Peggy. I'm only 9. Do you believe me?"
"Yes, I believe you."
It wasn't very dramatic, but the therapist was absolutely entranced, and that was the beginning of their multiple personality relationship. Sometimes she knew that she was putting it on, other times she didn't.
At one point, she wrote a letter recanting, and then she recanted her recanting.
What she says is, "Look, I'm really embarrassed to tell you this. I don't have multiple personalities. I don't even have 2 personalities. I don't really know why I did this or how I was able to. I just know that it was easy to do and that things are getting worse for me, not better. And I really want to do more therapy with you, but I want to do it honestly." And then the therapist by then had given talks. She was writing papers.
She was invested in this diagnosis.
She was invested. She told herself that the patient was still sick but didn't want more therapy, even though the letter said, "Please give me more therapy." I think the psychiatrist sort of implied to the patient, "Look, if you don't get with the program, that's it." The patient said, "Okay." You know, she wrote her a letter a few weeks later and said, "Some other person wrote that letter."
In the arc that was established by Sybil, the mother was the mother from hell. And for me, it seems to recall the early diagnoses of autism, which always laid blame on the quote-unquote refrigerator mom, now an entirely discredited idea.
I think that that's actually where it came from. The therapist came out of that tradition where everything was blamed on mothers.
"Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree.
Do you think it's just sunshine and singing and pretty colors when you grow up? Well, I should say not. You are bad. You are spoiled rotten. And you better learn quick."
Why? Schizophrenia, homosexuality. And I think she extended that theory into her ideas about Sybil's mother. The diagnosis, when it was really in its heyday, made a lot of people very, very sick. And the main problem with the diagnosis is that if you get it, it's assumed that you got it because you were severely, horridly abused and usually sexually. Well, imagine if you're a middle-aged woman, you've spent your entire life having nice thoughts about your parents, and suddenly you are having memories that are like utter nightmares, and you feel that you're in a nightmare.
Like the satanic cult scare of roughly the same period.
Well, as a matter of fact, the satanic cult scare came from multiple personality therapy. The first people to tell the stories of satanic sexual abuse were patients in therapy for multiple personality disorder.
What happened to Shirley Mason?
After her therapy, she got a job as an art professor at a small college, and this was before the book came out. She was doing very well. She got away from the therapist, got tenure at a little college, had her house, was popular at her job, and then the book came out. Her colleagues in art education recognized her, the townspeople where she grew up. The book had not really changed the details. For example, it said that her maid was named Bessie Flood, and the real maid's name was Desi Blood. There were many things like that. And she had a bunch of friends who knew that she'd been in therapy with the psychoanalyst in New York. And the psychoanalyst ended up having her name in the book. I mean, if she had just been anonymous, I don't think that Sybil would have been found out. And she left. She left almost in the dead of night. And she went to Lexington, Kentucky, where the therapist was. And she never lived apart from her after that.
Debbie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Debbie Nathan is a journalist and author of Sybil Exposed, the extraordinary story behind the famous multiple personality case.
She gave me a split personality. She tore me up inside. She caused me to live two different lives, like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Doug Anderson and Gianna Palmer, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org, where you can also check out our blog filled with even more OTM stuff. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.